Good evening, and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories we're covering today, Thursday, March 13th, 2014. Doctors Without Borders warns of thousands of internally displaced persons in Upper Nile State.
We've started to see the rainy season pouring its intensity to the area. It's a flooded area.
And President Kiir forms a committee to look into joining the East African community.
We are a new nation. We should not be isolated. We have to be in a block so that we speed up our productions.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. International medical charity Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, or Doctors Without Borders, says thousands of people are continuing to flee fighting in Upper Nile State. MSF says aid organizations are not able to meet the basic needs of people displaced by violence. From Juba, Magume Davis-Rakawinji has this report.
MSF Deputy Head of Mission Isaac Oko says IDPs in Melut County are suffering as the rain set in.
I was in Melut yesterday, and I can already confirm we've started to see the rainy season pouring its intensity to the area. We already start to see the concerns of the site where the population are. It's a flooded area. We obviously see also how miserable the kids are due to lack of food.
Oko says over 15,000 people are in two temporary camps set up by the displaced. Between them, they have to make do with 1,000 bags of sorghum that was given to them by local authorities. He says sanitation in the camp is very poor, increasing the risk of disease. Most people defecate in the open, as there are only 3-pit latrines available for the entire camp.
Wash activities remain dire. They are basically collecting water from the Nile. We know the risk that comes with, and the water is untreated. We already see a surge in diarrheal cases in our health facility, which is within the camp itself. They lack shelter.
MSF is treating at least 100 people daily because of the poor hygiene in the camps. Oko says the hardships faced by people in Melut County, some of whom have been displaced two or even three times since armed clashes broke out in the southern part of Upper Nile State, is little known outside of the immediate area.
Melut is not well talked of if you compare to other locations where the IDPs are. And as such, we see very lagged response, be it food provision, which is a real worry for us. We are also worried by the active influx of IDPs coming into Melut County. Obviously, if the numbers continue to surge, there will be an overstretch even to the host community, which don't have much.
He says with the rains intensifying, access to the IDPs in Melut will become even more complicated. Oko says 4,500 children in the camp have been vaccinated against polio and measles. UN and aid agencies say over 700,000 people have been displaced and 1,000 killed around South Sudan since fighting broke out in the country 3 months ago. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
President Salva Kiir yesterday appointed an 11-member committee to pave the way for South Sudan's admission to the East African community. In a decree read on state television last night, Mr. Kiir named Foreign Minister Barnaba Mariel Benjamin and Finance Minister Agrey Tisa Sabuni as co-chairs of the committee. But at least one analyst is skeptical about the benefits of joining the 5-member bloc. For VOA News, Philip Aleu has more from Juba.
South Sudan applied to join the regional body in 2011, immediately after gaining independence from Sudan. Foreign Affairs spokesman Mawien Makol Arig says the time is ripe for South Sudan to join the regional bloc. Makol says membership in the community will allow South Sudan to expand its revenue base away from oil.
We are going to diversify our economy to also look into minerals, agriculture, and other things that we wanted to share with other community, so that our small products can also go to the bigger market. And we'll also be really in a bigger international arena in terms of production. And this is going to help us. We are a new nation. We should not be isolated. We have to be in a block so that we speed up our productions.
But Farag Madwot, a Juba-based analyst, says it is too early for South Sudan to join the East African community. Madwot says South Sudan economy is in its infancy and joining the bloc could cause already high unemployment to its peak.
The common market obligates members to allow unimpeded access to all the other provisions that someone who wants to establish business wants to do in any part of South Sudan, all citizens of the members of the East African community. In the process, while we are now looking for dividends of peace and our young people who are educated and skilled are looking for something to do, we are going to establish competition that is very, very difficult for them to overcome with their own neighbors.
Madwot says citizens from the EAC have already flooded South Sudan job market, taking up several public and private sector jobs. He says if South Sudan joined the community and signed its treaties, more South Sudanese citizens could lose their jobs.
When members of our neighboring countries come here and work here, we give them on an individual basis. It still gives the government the flexibility to establish public policy that would empower its people. It can still give preference for local indigenous firms and companies. But once you sign a treaty, all those things become almost illegal in the context of the East African Treaty. So I think you are actually taking away all the instruments and tools that the government has to empower local employment, to empower local industry by acceding to the East African Treaty.
But Markol disagrees. The spokesman for the Foreign Affairs Ministry says membership of the regional body will speed up development in South Sudan. He says countries develop more quickly when they cooperate politically and economically with their neighbors. South Sudan membership of the EAC was put on hold in December after a technical team expressed concern about South Sudan's poor market economy structures and weak governance. But in January, the East African Community Secretariat said the regional body was likely to admit South Sudan in April, despite concerns over continued insecurity and armed conflicts. For BOA News, I'm Philippa Leu in Juba.
The international community is warning that South Sudan faces a possible famine if the ongoing crisis is not quickly brought to an end. Marta Vanderwolf has more from a summit of East African states in Addis Ababa.
South Sudan's government and rebel forces signed a cessation of hostilities agreement in January, but fighting continues and peace talks in Addis Ababa have made little progress. U.S. Special Envoy Donald Booth expressed his concerns about the situation Thursday during the extraordinary summit of the East African bloc IGAD, which has been mediating the peace talks between South Sudan's warring factions. Booth says there's deep disappointment that neither side is respecting the ceasefire.
This failure has led to thousands of additional deaths and an ever-worsening humanitarian situation, with South Sudan facing a possible famine.
The rainy season is approaching South Sudan, but many fields remain unplanted because people have been chased from their homes and are afraid of being attacked if they return. 85% of South Sudanese households are believed to be engaged in pastoral farming and depend on livestock and agriculture. With the rainy season just weeks away, European Union Special Envoy to the Horn of Africa Alexander Rondos says urgency is needed to avoid a famine.
If people cannot go and plant, there will not be sufficient stocks within months. Livestock, a large proportion of the livestock population of a country populated by so many people who have pastoralist economy, is lost. It is absolutely essential that all the necessary steps be made.
The fighting in South Sudan between forces of the president and his former vice president has left tens of thousands of people dead and displaced nearly a million. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
A new report says ending persistent hunger and undernutrition should be top development priorities. The International Food Policy Research Institute, IFRI, has released its annual Global Food Policy Report. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
IFPRI has set a goal of 2025 for ending hunger and undernutrition. The UN estimates more than 840 million people still go hungry every day, while over 2 billion have a deficiency of essential micronutrients, such as iron, vitamin A, and zinc. Although very high, those figures actually represent an improvement in recent years, but the progress has not been uniform. The report says there are still major hunger challenges in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. Shengen Fan is IFPRI Director General.
We have made tremendous progress in the last several decades. So poverty has come down, and the nutrition has come down. However, we are still facing some tremendous challenges.
Fan says solving hunger and undernutrition is a moral issue.
We got to work together to solve that problem. Secondly, it is also an economic issue. It makes a lot of economic sense by reducing hunger and malnutrition.
He says there is a very large return for every dollar invested in reducing hunger. The IFPRI report lists Brazil, China, Thailand, and Vietnam as having made dramatic progress with policies that emphasize improving agriculture, providing social safety nets, and targeting nutrition programs at those most in need. Fan says it requires cooperation among governments, the private sector, civil society, farmers, and others.
So you have different kinds of approaches that can reduce hunger, malnutrition in a short period of time, let's say in 20 years, even 10 years. Why I'm pushing for 2025 is because if we keep the current momentum, the momentum we have created in the last 2 or 3 years, put nutrition very high in development agenda, I believe we can do it by 2025.
The report says, however, that the development agenda should not pursue the achievement of environmental sustainability goals at the expense of food and nutritional security and the well-being of poor and hungry people.
Why we need a sustainable world is because we wanted to have a sustainable world for people, but it must be people-focused. However, if we do not tackle some of the environmental issues, climate change issues, then obviously people will suffer. So yes, in many areas, there may be some trade-offs. However, there are many synergies as well. How can we produce enough nutritious food by using less water, less land, emit less carbon emission? So there are lots of synergies.
Fan says new priorities must be set as the Millennium Development Goals come due. The MDGs, which include reducing hunger, will expire at the end of next year. He says so far there's nothing official to replace them, but meetings are underway to do so.
There are many, many different working groups led by UN, by a high-level panel, by civil societies, by many different groups. So 2014 will be a critical year for different stakeholders to make their contribution to the debate. So finally, it is the national governments who have to own the strategy, who have to own the agenda. So unless they own it, I'm afraid the goals we set will not be achieved.
The IFPRI Director General says it's a matter of political will, accountability, and adequate resources. He adds, besides the current focus on staple crops, maize, rice, and wheat, emphasis must also be placed on more nutritious foods, such as vegetables and fruits. He also warns against the current trend in many developing countries of eating more processed foods containing large amounts of fat, sugar, and salt. He says this can lead to the double dilemma of obesity and undernutrition. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Sadly, sexual attacks on women occur in many circumstances, in many communities, and the victims are not at fault. Sexual violence is a serious crime. Individuals that have been attacked should seek immediate medical attention. In addition to pregnancy, there are psychological dangers and the risk of sexually transmitted diseases such as HIV. That's why victims should seek medical help immediately. Physical and psychological trauma must both be treated quickly. It's also important that people do not blame the victims. Hopefully, with family and community support, can the healing begin?
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, AU forces say they've taken back more territory from Al-Shabaab in Somalia. Stay tuned.
For all the latest in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to Voice of America's South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. You can email us at southsudan@voanews.com.
southsudan@voanews.com.
We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan.
www.voanews.com/South Sudan.
Or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what should be done to protect the rights of the minority groups in your country?
I think if we increase awareness and then just give them the minority groups a voice to say what they need, how they need it, and then if our leaders also could like help them achieve what they need to achieve so that they're no longer just the forgotten, it would be good.
The minority should be represented. Like, if there is youth, the youth are represented, the drafts are represented, everything should be represented so that they can pick a representative to speak on behalf of them.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. African Union forces say they have reclaimed more territory from the Al-Qaeda-linked militant group Al-Shabaab in renewed military operations across the country. VOA East Africa correspondent Gabe Joslow reports that restoring the Somalian government's political authority remains a pressing challenge.
The AU peacekeeping force in Somalia, known as AMISOM, said Thursday that Djiboutian soldiers have taken control of territory in Hiran region, north of the capital, extending recent military gains. AMISOM spokesman Colonel Ali Hamoud:
there are small towns to which Djiboutians are moving, but the objective is far beyond that.
VOA's Somali service reports that Djiboutian, Ethiopian, and Somali troops recaptured Bolaberbe town, about 125 kilometers north of Mogadishu. In the past week, Ethiopian soldiers under AMISOM retook control of several key towns in southwestern Somalia. Somali officials said in some cases, Al-Shabaab had fled from their positions before confronting the advancing soldiers. The current operations represent the most significant progress regional forces have made against the militants since 2012, when the Kenyan military took control of the port city of Kismayo. But military success does not come without challenges. Mohamed Musa Tere, executive director of the Somali Institute for Policy and Strategic Studies, notes that political disputes can arise quickly when territory is rapidly reclaimed.
What we have realized before, that some area was liberated from Al-Shabaab, but there was not a political strategy in place. And what happened is there was a power vacuum, but also clan infighting.
Kismayo serves as an example. After Al-Shabaab fled the city, a power struggle emerged between the Somali federal government, a Kenyan-backed regional leader, and other local actors. At one point, five different men claimed to be the president of a newly formed state around Kismayo. The next challenge could be Gedo region, which borders both Ethiopia and Kenya in southwestern Somalia, and where AMISOM has seized territory from Al-Shabaab. Tare, who comes from Gedo, sees the possibility of a struggle for influence between Somalia's neighbors.
Because Kenya wants certain people to come forward, Ethiopia may come up with other people, and then you will come and there'll be a circle of conflicts. If they are not having a common strategy where the government has a role.
In a message earlier this week, Al-Shabaab's leader Ahmed Abdi Godane called on Somalis to take up arms against Ethiopian forces inside Somalia. Despite losing territory to AMISOM in recent years, the militant group has continued to launch suicide attacks against government and international targets, including an assault on the presidential palace in Mogadishu last month that killed at least 17 people. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
The Internal Displacement Monitoring Center says women and children make up 70% of the world's internally displaced population, and young girls pay the biggest price of displacement. The group issued a briefing paper entitled Girl Disrupted. It highlights the effects of violence, early marriage, and disasters on girls' lives. Sophie Crozet is a trainer and legal officer for the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center. She spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the problems facing young girls without a home.
Well, in most of the countries that IDMC is monitoring, we know that 70% of the whole displaced community is composed of women and children. And in these countries, women and children usually hold quite a submissive role already and do face some issues, and especially gender inequality when dealing with accessing basic services or basic human rights. Displacement makes it even more difficult for them, and they are much more vulnerable in chaotic displacement environments than they were before. For example, girls in chaotic displacement environments are much more likely to be victims of abuses, especially sexual abuses, especially when they don't have access to shelter or privacy.
Were there any particular countries that stood out where girls were being victimized more so than other places?
In the briefing paper, we try to show that it does impact girls all over the world. So we have cases from Central African Republic, which is a hot country right now, and that is facing an emergency with more than 700,000 new displaced persons since the beginning of the new crisis. But we also show cases, stories from long-lasting and protracted situations in Palestine or in Afghanistan. Their problems are different, but they do face specific issues that are to be taken into account. For example, we in this paper, Girl Disrupted, we talk about the terrible issue of early and forced marriages that girls do face, especially in situations of displacement. Unfortunately, it happens also in normal situations, but displacement do make the conditions in which people live much more difficult, and parents who lose everything, and especially their jobs and their livelihood during displacement, are sometimes forced to make terrible decisions, and sometimes the decision of marrying a six-year-old little girl, as it's showcased in the story that we gathered from Afghanistan for this report.
What is being done to address the issue of victimizing and traumatizing young girls who are displaced?
In this report, we choose to talk about education in emergency because one of the consequences of displacement is disruption of education. And this leads to, well, disruption of a child's normal life, of education, but also protection issues. While they are not in school, girls are much more likely to be harassed or to be confined at home and in even marriage early. So education on emergency is one of the solutions that should be taken as soon as possible, especially in terms of programming, making sure that these education programs are gender-friendly and tackle the issues of the obstacles to girls' access to school. And we are recommending consultation with local authorities and local leaders in order to ensure that girls go back to school as soon as possible and are able to bounce back and find their childhood again.
Sophie Crozet is a trainer and legal officer for the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center. She spoke with Kim Lewis from Geneva. South Africa's Johannesburg is chatty and concise. According to a new study, the city's metro area averages one geotag tweet every 13 seconds, leading the African continent in Twitter usage. Peter Cox reports from Johannesburg on the tweeting trends of Africa.
It's not a huge surprise that Johannesburg sends out tweets more frequently than any other city in Africa. That's what the How Africa Tweets survey from Portland Communications found after looking at Twitter statistics from October to December in 2013. Johannesburg is an economic leader in Africa, and South Africa has the highest smartphone penetration of any nation on the continent. Alan Kamau heads the Nairobi office for Portland Communications.
Also, Egypt featured highly. Cairo, Alexandria, other top cities in terms of active tweeting. Moving to East Africa, Nairobi is the most active, not surprising. It's sixth most active on the continent.
The study was conducted by sorting through all geotagged Twitter posts. That means that a user allows their device to show their location or puts location information into their tweet. So these numbers don't necessarily reflect the total amount of tweets out of each city. But Kamau says they do give a reliable estimate for the amount of Twitter usage.
It should be a broad indicator of, you know, the trends within the Twitter sphere. It's representative enough for it to be a broad kind of indicator of Twitter activity, trends in terms of how people are using it.
The company has done the survey twice now, and Kamau said the largest change he's seen is how Twitter is being used.
In terms of topics, one of the shifts that we've seen is, you know, when we looked at our survey in 2012, was that it was very much social conversations online. We're seeing much more corporate, so many more companies having a presence online. So brands having a greater share of voice, being more active, engaging consumers directly.
He said consumers are also using Twitter to air out issues with bad products or services, not only with companies, but government as well.
It's a much more public place, and also it's a direct channel, you know, it's a direct and public channel to complain, and people organize very well, as you know, on social media.
Kamau says companies, governments, and organizations, even sports teams, see great potential in marketplace engagement. The top topic of Twitter across the continent is football.
Africans love football, are very passionate about their football teams, and, you know, Twitter provides a platform, again, for fans to get behind their team. So, you know, the most mentioned football team is Johannesburg's Orlando Pirates. And I think, you know, it's just a fantastic platform for that kind of thing.
Miki Modisane, public relations director for the Orlando Pirates, agrees. The team's Twitter handle has 145,000 followers and is used frequently.
Sometimes we tweet close to about 15 to 20 times in a day. With regard to, it could be about players' availability ahead of the match, ticket sales, PR activities, PR campaigns.
He's happy that his team is one of the most talked about teams on Twitter.
For us, we're quite excited. It simply means that something good that we're doing as far as social network is concerned, you know, and as far as Twitter is concerned, because we definitely engage our fans.
That might be something to tweet about. Peter Cox for VOA News, Johannesburg.
That's our show for today. We leave you with the song "You Are Not Alone" by Michael Jackson.
Another day is gone. I'm still on.
We've been listening to the late superstar Michael Jackson and his song "You Are Not Alone." I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. It's been nice to have you with us. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Just the other night.